Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. It's great to have everybody joining us here for this show. We've got a great discussion here and a new guest to bring on the show, and we're excited about that. Before we get too far into the rest of the episode and everything that's coming up, though, it's always important to recognize our co-host and the person who helps plan all of this nonsense. And so, Sam Bradley, what are you doing?
I'm planning more of this nonsense, Jamie. We got a lot of good people in the wings that I'm anxious to get a hold of. But you know, it's sort of like herding cats sometimes, especially when you're dealing with doctors. No offense, Andy, but they're hard to get scheduled sometime. But we did. We have our friend Kevin Ryder. I was able to corral him, if you'll excuse a Texas expression, and get him up here with us again. We have some really interesting topics tonight and interesting guests, and we'll say hi to Kevin. But first, it's hot.
It's really hot. In fact, as we're recording this, record heat wave has been hitting the desert southwest of the United States. It's actually moving into the central plains states now. But four people killed in a record-setting heat wave. Temperatures so high that some of the search and rescue operations for missing hikers have been called off. And of course, then on top of that, there's a large wildfire going on in some parts of the Southwest, including outside of the Angeles National Forest, outside of Los Angeles, and another one in Arizona. And, you know, so of course, it's imagine wearing firefighting gear in 120 degree heat and fighting a fire at the same time. And you can imagine how devastating that could be on the firefighters. So just a really significant weather. And again, we just come back to this recurring theme where be prepared for what's likely to occur in your region. And that might be a wildfire or forest fire this time of year. As temperatures get hot and the tinder gets dry, it can be a significant situation to affect your community.
Absolutely. And it's interesting here in Colorado because, you know, I'm used to the California, you know, hot all day and most of the nights. But it's been 56 at night and 95 during the day. So that's a huge leap. And then it goes back down to 56 again. So at least we get some relief at night. And oh boy, I remember all those wildfires in California. Kevin, I bet it's warm down there in Texas, eh?
No, it's only like 93. It's still kind of cool.
Yeah, I talked to a friend in San Diego today who said it was 109, and that's a place that's usually pretty cool. Our guest today, Andy Tenner, she's a doc from UCSF, and she could tell you more about herself. But, you know, usually it's pretty cool in San Francisco. Have you escaped the heat, Andy?
Yeah, I think we're getting up into the 70s today, so people are starting to complain a little bit, but otherwise we're all right.
Well, it's a funny thing because people talk about the weather in San Francisco, but they don't realize that San Francisco itself is like an island unto itself because of all of the breezes coming off the bay. It is significantly cooler there than it is on the East Bay where I used to live. So I'm sure going inland, it's probably quite hot out there as it tends to be as you get more toward the Central Valley. So I'm sure they're heating it up out there.
Yeah, the temperature change happens pretty quickly as you move across into the East Bay.
Yes, it does. But we're not going to talk about that anymore. Well, we will. But, you know, the thing, Jamie, about that really bothers me, but it's the truth, is, you know, when you have lost hikers that may be unprepared, now you have rescuers that are at risk going in to get them. And it's a really hard thing for them, as well as for the people, the groups that are going out there, to have to call them in. But you got to consider their safety as well. So that I wouldn't want to be the one having to make that decision.
Yeah, it's significant. Actually, I saw some video on the news yesterday, some Cal Fire crews having to walk in over a mile up a trail to retrieve a hiker who had suffered heat exhaustion and bring them out on like a two-wheeled rolling Stokes basket kind of arrangement. And I could just imagine how, you know, hot it must have been to traipse in there and then roll somebody back out again over some rough terrain.
Oh, my God, I can't imagine. Well, Kevin, you teach wilderness safety. You know, what are your thoughts you might impart to our listening audience on that kind of thing?
Stay hydrated, rest often, don't overheat yourself, don't become a victim.
Simple and easy right there, yeah. Pretty basic, huh?
Yeah, it's pretty basic. I would say common sense, but any more
there
days,
is that, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, don't become a victim. You're the rescuer. You're supposed to be smarter and more highly trained. So when you get hot, find shade, take a 5-minute break, change the socks, drink some water, cool off. Yep.
Yeah, hydration is huge, obviously. Well, Andy, we're gonna switch gears here a little bit. Jason tells us that you've had some adventures. We're going from heat to Ebola here. But you have some, you had, now what's the organization that you're with? I noticed on your email signature.
Yeah, so I'm faculty at University of California, San Francisco, in the Department of Emergency Medicine. So that's my day job. I work at the San Francisco General Hospital, which is our level one trauma center in the city.
Ah, yes. Know it well.
Yes.
I have friends that work there.
Yeah, no, it's the safety net hospital. It's a great place to work. Definitely see all kinds of things in that emergency department. But I also do a lot of global health work. I primarily work with the African Federation for Emergency Medicine in sub-Saharan Africa. But when the Ebola outbreak happened, I was actually contacted by a friend of mine who works for International Rescue Committee, which is a non-governmental organization that works primarily in healthcare, complex emergencies and health crisis. They've been in Sierra Leone for 21 years. They had several educational programs that were running in Sierra Leone when the outbreak happened. And he was brought in to try to help with some of their healthcare response and had contacted me to come out and help him. It was a little awkward because at the time I had just taken the position at UCSF. So I had been here about 2 months. When I basically had to go to my boss and say, thanks for the job. Do you mind if I go for a couple months?
You're not the only disaster worker in that ER. Some of our DMAT people work there, and I'm sure this isn't news to them.
Yeah, no. Well, and UCSF was actually wonderful. In a time when a lot of other universities were pulling their faculty or prohibiting their faculty from responding because of the fear, the chancellor for UCSF actually came out and said, we want to support any of our faculty that want to go. We want to be as helpful as we can in any way possible. And so UCSF actually paid for most of my time there. They facilitated me being able to go. And really, they were really supportive with the response efforts there. So they were wonderful.
That's very cool. That's really good to hear. That's really good to hear because they recognize the work you're doing and how important it is, and that's awesome.
Yeah, it made me feel like I'd made a good career choice moving to UCSF. So,
yeah, seriously. I mean, that's the kind of organization you want to work for because they're not all like that.
Absolutely.
Because ERs, I mean, depending on the configuration, I know a lot of the docs on my DMAT, they work within physicians' organizations that they cover each other when one of them's gone. But, you know, when you have several of them that are on the same team and a disaster hits and they all want to go, it's like, okay, now what do we do? So yeah. It's really difficult to make sure that they're, you know, the ER is covered when everybody's running off to wherever to manage a disaster.
Right, right. And well, that's one of the, you know, one of the interesting things about disaster response, especially from academic centers, because you have all of these other, you know, obligations. So I have obligations to the patients in San Francisco proper, as well as our residents and trainees. So for me to be able to go really took a departmental effort. A lot of my colleagues who weren't able to go physically themselves kicked in by picking up some of my shifts or picking up some of my educational responsibilities. So it really was, it sort of took a village, I guess, to be able to go and respond.
That is a really neat approach, and I'm glad to hear that. So you went down to South America, was it?
I had done some...
Go ahead.
Sorry, I had done some work in South America prior.
Okay.
I'd done some work in Guatemala and Peru, but most of my work in the past few years has been in sub-Saharan Africa.
Well, tell us more about that. That's not a place I know much about, other than it's hot there, probably.
Yeah, for the most part, it's pretty hot.
That's as much as I can tell you.
Yeah. So I work primarily with the African Federation for Emergency Medicine. So emergency medicine, not only as a specialty, but also as a concept. So the idea that you have patients that come in that are undifferentiated, meaning you don't know what they have, who come in with life-threatening conditions where you have to make decisions quickly. That's the concept of being able to treat those patients or how to treat those patients is fairly new in the lifespan of health education, even in the U.S. You know, our EMS systems and emergency departments, as we know them today, have only been in existence for the past 30 to 40 years. So in sub-Saharan Africa, you often have what they call casualty wards, and usually that's a place where there's a few beds. There's usually a house officer or a sort of the lowest person on the totem pole, whoever drew the short straw, has to go and sit in that mm-hmm. area without a lot of resources. And usually they see patients as they come. You know, if you happen to be 20 in, you know, 20th in the line, but you are sicker than the 19 people in front of you, you wait to be seen until you get to your turn. And so there's a lot of excess death and long-term disability that happens because of that system. And so the African Federation for Emergency Medicine has been working to try to improve education and emergency care, to advocate for pre-hospital care. You know, how do you get from the world where bad things happen to you into definitive care? That has to happen. It happens everywhere. But whether it happens in an organized fashion or not depends on whether people have recognized that that's an issue and have invested or either time or resources into trying to develop that. So
Yeah, I was just going to say developing the concept of triage for those people. So, you know, nobody's feeling slighted if you're bringing in people that really need more immediate care. Would they be amenable to that?
Yeah, I think it's the same as here. You know, I think once people understand what you're doing and they realize that, you know, it, as long as you're transparent about it, that it's not, you know, this person's not coming in ahead of you because they slipped us a 20 on the way in. You know, we've assessed them and they need attention more urgently. People, I think, are pretty amenable to that once you explain it to them. And I think, you know, one of the things that was really interesting about the response to Ebola was it was one of the first times in a lot of these countries people had been introduced to the concept that you could ask someone a few questions and differentiate their level of care or level of risk just from getting a few questions, which is basically what our triage is. It was an Ebola-specific triage, but the idea of having people come in, asking them some questions, and then determining whether they needed to have further testing or whether they could go on to other care was a fairly new concept, but one that was adapted pretty quickly. I mean, people, they realized the need for it, and that became part of the culture fairly rapidly.
Did you have a language barrier with those folks?
Yes.
And a little about their language.
Yeah, not only, I mean, in Sierra Leone, one of the main business languages is English, but that's generally people who have completed education, you know, have gone into higher level of schooling, speak English. And most people speak some English, but as you get into more rural areas, you get into local languages and then tribal languages. There can be dozens to hundreds of, depending on where you are. So one of the reasons that I wanted to work with IRC, with International Rescue Committee, was because part of the way that they approached their response to the Ebola outbreak was by using local staff. So they trained a lot of local nurses, they trained a lot of local technicians in environmental health, and train them to be hygienists, which were basically, that was our term for the people that mixed the chlorine and kept the buckets full and sprayed down the healthcare workers as they were coming out. from the units and their PPE, the personal protective equipment.
That makes perfect sense, and it engages the locals.
Yeah.
It gives them a job, and that's good for everybody. Jamie, do you have any thoughts? Sitting there quietly in the background.
No, I was just thinking that, you know, it's interesting to hear about this from the inside. We've seen some other things. We've talked about the U.S. Ebola response when it was going on. And so it's interesting to really get a look at the inside of what was going on in sub-Saharan Africa during the outbreak. And, you know, Andy, I'm curious what it was like operating in PPE in that austere environment, in that those hot conditions, and where there were, you know, how did you manage your own well-being in the midst of all of that?
Yeah, I have to say, of all the places I've worked and all the things I've done, that was the most physically miserable work that I've ever done. The PPE was awful. It was a necessary evil, but it was awful. It was 80 or 90 degrees outside with 90% humidity, and you're putting a garbage bag on and walking around for an hour. So it was just very uncomfortable. But one of the things, you know, as you were talking about earlier with the heat-related response, and really as a responder, having to make sure that you take care of yourself first, that was one of the things we had to really instill in our workers, because, you know, when everybody that's working in a Ebola treatment center, an isolation unit, as we called them, you're there for a mission. You have a lot of patients there. And especially for our isolation units, the patients that were there were often friends and neighbors of our workers. And so you have a personal investment in the response, and you want to do the best you can for people. And that tends to, you know, people tend to push themselves in those kind of circumstances. And it's really important not to push yourself. If you pass out in PPE, it's a disaster. I mean, that PPE, if it rips, if your goggles fall off or your mask falls off, you have an exposure. And with Ebola, it doesn't take a lot to catch it. And so, you know, we really had to work with our workers about how we were going to manage the unit. So what we did, you had a maximum time of 1 hour in the PPE. And we wrote the time that you went in on your PPE with a marker. And everybody had, you always went in with two people. So everybody had a buddy. And then we would also have our staff not in PPE would be along the walkway. So we try to design our units so that you could see into, there weren't blind spots in the units. So we could see without being in PPE what was happening. So if there was a problem, we could send somebody in to help fix it. But one of the things that I found really interesting about being in PPE was you had about 10 minutes of active brain time. And then after that, it was just too hot and you were in task completion mode. So you couldn't really task switch. If something happened in the unit while you were in PPE, you didn't really have the brain capacity at that point to be able to manage that well. So what would happen is if you're in there to give, to draw blood or to give the oral rehydration solution that we were giving to everybody, or to check on patients, if a patient passed out or if a patient started vomiting blood or seizing or something happened to the patient, you indicated to one of the people that was outside that was helping, your sort of buddy that was on the outside of the fence, and they would have somebody go in and suit up. And it's a hard thing to do as a healthcare provider to walk away from somebody who's having, you know, obviously having trouble or having difficulty, but we had to, for everyone's safety, we realized that when you're in that kind of environment, you can't, at that point in your time in the PPE, it's very difficult for you to be able to switch to help anybody. And so what we would have them do is complete their task. Somebody else would get suited up quickly, come in and address that patient and do whatever it was that they needed. And then the first person would come out and doff their PPE. Because it was a really interesting world to be in, where you just, it was for the safety of everybody, you had to make sure that that people went in, they completed one task, and they left. If there was another task that came up, somebody else had to go in.
I think that's a perspective we've never heard in all the discussions we've had with people responding into that type of thing. We've never really heard that. It just what it's like to be in PPE, and oh my God. So here's a question that a lot of people in podcast land are probably asking. You come from a nice, cool environment, UCSF. What would possess you? And we D-Matters get asked this all the time. What possesses you to want to go down there into that environment and help those people?
My parents asked me that several times, actually, on my way up. I think it's just how we're wired. But I also think, you know, my training was in, you know, I trained in emergency medicine as well as internal medicine. And I did an extra certificate course in tropical infectious disease. And then my master's in public health was in humanitarian crisis. And so, you know, you had a humanitarian crisis involving tropical infectious disease. And I just felt like I couldn't not be there. There was a skill set that I had that I felt like I needed to share. And I think it was one of those scenarios, you know, I don't have kids. It's fairly easy for me to go and do something like that. I'm not putting anybody else in danger by doing that. And I just felt like it was needed. And in talking to my friend who was working with IRC, you know, he was leading their development of their Ebola isolation units in Sierra Leone, and it was really difficult for them to get people to come out there for obvious reasons. And I just felt like I needed to be there. But I was also very cognizant of the fact that there was nothing about me that made me any different from any of those patients that got Ebola. And so I think that's one of the things going into this was the reality that I could be putting myself at risk and that I had to be very careful about how I responded. And, you know, and again, in the same way with the PPE, if I get Ebola, that takes a lot of resources to medevac me. It would take a lot of resources away from the people that I was there to help. So that was one of the things that I had to be really careful of. And then I think all of the responders that I worked with were really cognizant of that. It's not just, you know, it's not just us out there being cowboys. There was a system that had to be in place. And if we were reckless, we would put other people at risk.
Wow. Yeah. There's just so many things to think about that I don't think most people think about when they look at people going into that kind of environment. So one more question for me, I'll let Jamie and Kevin jump in there if they like, but, we've discussed this with our DMATs and Joe, of course, is on USAR, and it's, how do you think these kinds of experiences make you a better doctor?
I think that having to think outside the box or think in a different way from my usual everyday practice helps me to be a little bit more flexible, and I think take a broader vantage point when I'm taking care of patients in the U.S. I think the other thing that was really fascinating about this, I mean, every time I go to another country, every time I work in another place, I'm always really humbled about the things that exist in the world that I don't know of or the perspectives that I haven't experienced. And one of the things that I thought was really striking about this response was about this experience was the stigma that the patients faced, that our local healthcare workers faced, and the sort of rampant rumors. I mean, even, you know, in the U.S. where the viral definition of disease, I mean, pretty much I think most people in the U.S. sort of accept that there are viruses and there are tiny particles that nobody can see and that they can get in and they can get in and cause problems and even kill you. But when you're in a culture where, you know, a lot of people define this as witchcraft, and you're trying to explain to patients why they have to, you have to take all of their belongings and burn them, and you know, they're just, it makes you think differently about other cultures and how people think about things. And I think that perspective and realizing what other people were facing helps me hear when I have patients who have diseases that are stigmatized or conditions that are stigmatized, or that I feel like they're not understanding what I'm trying to say. It helps me to try to relate to people here.
Yes, and a big one is, you know, it takes me right back to the HIV crisis and all the stigma that, you know, and of course in San Francisco, you still have a lot of that running around. So I'm sure there's a direct correlation there and how well you treat those people because you understand that kind of stigma.
Yeah, absolutely. So, a lot of people actually made a lot, you know, I wasn't practicing early in the HIV epidemic, but a lot of people who were made, drew a lot of connections with that.
Exactly. Kevin, any thoughts?
I would love to be able to do that if I only had my doctor.
I'm sure they have other people.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually loving this. I would love to. That's kind of my ultimate thing would be to travel to foreign lands and help people out without being a doctor. So yeah. I'm along for the ride on this one. I'm just loving this.
Well, it's actually, you bring up a really interesting point. And I will say that as a physician, I think I was probably the least important person in that isolation unit. You know, we had a lot of people that, honestly, the most important people in the isolation unit were our hygienists and our laundry workers, the people who slopped chlorine all over everything and kept our scrubs clean so that we could come back to work the next day and who were mixing the chlorine and our sprayers and our trainers. I will say it was a very humbling experience to realize that, you know, I was helping to coordinate things and I was helping to coordinate the medical care, but really the most important people were the ones who were making the whole system work. And from that standpoint too, as medics for the African Federation for Emergency Medicine, I can tell you, well, you know, we would love to have you guys come and help with this. One of the things that we've been trying to advocate for is pre-hospital care. And, you know, one of the things that we had in Sierra Leone is we had ambulance drivers, but we didn't have people who, there was no really not care delivered. You had people that were, you know, that were driving the ambulance, but they weren't trained in how to deliver healthcare on the scene. And I think that's a key component of emergency care systems that really needs to be developed. I don't think you have to be a doctor to do all of this stuff. I think the healthcare system works because we have people in all disciplines that work together. And so we need representation from all disciplines.
Well, then that takes me back to the early days of EMS in the United States when people were just first responders and ran around in white jackets and mm-hmm. that's all they did. And you said the magic word. It all comes back down to training. You know, they recognized that taking some firefighters, even though people were crazy about that idea, but training them to be paramedics and deliver that care in the field is exactly what needed to happen. And,
absolutely.
It always seems to come back to training, huh, Jamie?
Yeah, I think it does. And you know, this is a good time to segue and just thank our sponsors, Paragon Medical Education Group. They provide some excellent training surrounding disaster response specifically. And one of the things that they've talked about, and you know, Dr. Joe Holly and Jim Logan and the rest of the team at Paragon have been instrumental in helping different organizations around the country prepare for that once-in-a-lifetime response, whether it's an active shooter incident, whether it's a major tornado or earthquake or fire or whatever the case may be. When you have these situations occur in your community, it can be devastating to the responders unless they're adequately prepared and trained to take care of themselves, and then they can take care of their community. And I think, Andy, you talked about that very well, that you needed to really be aware of yourself so that you could be at the best for your patients.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So we want to thank Paragon, and of course you can find them over at paragonmedicalgroup.com, also over at paragonmededu on Twitter, and Paragon Medical Education Group as well. Just look them up on Facebook or Google them or wherever you'd like to look, and see if you can bring them into your community for your jurisdiction, and help find a way to get this type of experiential training for your organization so that you can find out how to be best prepared for when an event happens in your area. Sam, this has been a great episode, I have to say.
It has. I mean, I learned so much from Andy that, you know, we discussed a lot about these different kinds of deployments, but we've never heard it quite from the inside perspective as she gave us, like what it's like to be in a 100 plus degrees with 90 degree humidity in a trash bag. I can have a hard time. But just the fact that she would go down there knowing that this is going to be less than comfortable, but still willing to do it for these people, I can't commend you enough for that, Andy.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
Andy, is there some place that people can find out more information about maybe IRC or some of the other things you've been doing?
Yeah, so IRC has a website, it's rescue.org, and then the African Federation for Emergency Medicine also has a website called, it's at afem.info, I-N-F-O, and then, you know, the UCSF Department of Emergency Medicine has a link to some of our fellowship and our the work that our department has been doing as well. It's off of UCSF's website.
Excellent. Well, we'll have links to that in the show notes and make sure we share those with everybody so that they can follow up on them. And thanks again for coming on the show.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Kevin, where can folks find you?
They can find me at wildsafety.com. I have links to all the social media sites and everything from there.
Excellent. And thanks for joining us on this episode. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me, Jay. I appreciate it.
And Sam, how about you?
Well, you can find me in the usual social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 or thedisasterpodcast.com. And we hope that you, if you come up and have some questions for Andy on her adventures or her organization, I'm sure she wouldn't mind responding to them or anything else. So we'd certainly like to hear from you on the kinds of subjects that you have an interest in that it's hard to think that we may not have touched on yet, but we know that they're out there. So please let us know. And Jamie, where do we find you?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic on most social media sites. And, of course, all my various podcasts and ventures are searchable under that. And, of course, always over at disasterpodcast.com, where we try to cover a lot of different topics regarding a lot of different situations that are both man-made and natural that occur to people in different parts of the world. And so we really have tried to touch on something a little different this time, and I think it's been a great episode. And so we urge you to go over and leave a comment over at disasterpodcast.com. Let us know what you'd like to hear more of. If you have a question for Andy, definitely leave a comment, and we'll get back to her and let her know about it. And she can either email us an answer or go over and leave an answer herself, but we will get an answer to your questions. Sam, you know, this has been a great episode to just look at things from, like you said, from a different perspective that we hadn't really covered before. I mean, we touched on the African response just as basically a news item in the past, but here to get an inside look at what was going on the ground, I think has been fantastic, and certainly shows that, you know, this type of response in austere medicine is different from what we're used to.
Exactly. It's just another great example that austere medicine and disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.